Colorful Living Tip of the Day, number 348. Remember life's absurdities and always celebrate them. Like the time when Nana just demolished any chance at being cool in her granddaughter's eyes by responding, "Susan Boyle," when asked to name her favorite Beatle. I'm Chris Rodell, and this is the Use All the Crayons podcast, dedicated to giving you all the answers as to how we keep things so darn colorful right here in the lovely Laurel Islands. Today we're going to be talking about petty professional jealousies and how to deal with them. If the nation of Turkey has a national bird, and all about the time I pretended to be a crossdresser for WDVE morning show, just so I could get a peek at the women's fitting rooms. The fondness I feel for colleagues is in direct conflict with my resentment over their success. The more successful you are as a writer, the less likely it'll be that I'll be inviting you to join me rubbing elbows with the local elites here at the Tin Lizzie. And in the interest of accuracy, it's unlikely you'll actually see any elbows. What you will see is sleeve after sleeve after sleeve of soft faded flannel. It's just one reason you won't see John Grisham or J.K. Rowling spinning the spam wheel here at the Tin. If you're more successful than I, and yet I still like you, well, that says something about your character. So based on that formula, you can surmise I'm very fond of Jason. He's been a top golf writer for more than 25 years. He commemorated the milestone by releasing a series of lists, such as top 5 great golf experiences, most expensive courses, poshest clubhouses. You know, the kind of stuff we writers come up with when we really want to stick it to the other prestigious writers who cover things like war and climate change. I'm talking about the stuff that means only slightly less than freebie golf, one of the strongest motivations with which golfing writers must deal. Here's how I dealt with it. I wallowed in it. I allowed it to gloriously sidetrack about 10 years of my so-called career. From 1999 through 2009, I was a well-credentialed golf writer as there was. I wrote golf stories for Golf, Maximum Golf, Travel and Leisure Golf, Sports Illustrated, and more. And this was mostly before I could drop the Arnold Palmer name. I was getting invited to play golf all over North America. That's how I met Jason. We both accepted invitations to tour the Bear Trace in Tennessee. It's a string of Jack Nicklaus courses that stretch from Memphis to Crossville. Jason and I were with about a dozen other rowdies, and boy, did we have a ball. Bourbon, honky-tonks, barbecue, and the kind of golf camaraderie that leads to lifelong friendships. I thought about it after I read Jason's story. That could have been me. How different would my life have been had I chased free golf as my primary motivation? It's by no stretch of the imagination successful as I am now. But writing golf stories isn't making anyone rich, but man, oh man, think of those perks. What perks has writing golf gotten me? Well, for one, friends like Jeff Page. Jeff stopped by to talk to me at my table outside Second Chapter Books in Fort Ligonier days about 5 years ago. We talked and talked and talked. Heck, we haven't stopped talking. Just had lunch with him last week. I guess what I'm trying to say is the material perks for authors fall short of those bestowed on golf writers. But it'd be impossible to calculate the good friends I've made through writing books that matter to people who read. I guess I'm lucky to be in a field where the perks are the people.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
I'm great, how are you, Chris?
Good. Who are you and what are you doing here?
My name is Jeff Page and I am a friend of the famous local author, Chris Rodell.
Where are you?
I'm in the second story bar at Tin Lizzie, better known as Flappers.
What are you doing here?
I'm enjoying some time with my friend Chris Rodell.
Do you have any colorful living tips of the day?
Colorful living tip number 111. Ask friends if they think the females who work at the Elmer's Glue Factory refer to themselves as Bond girls, or if they think that would make them seem stuck up.
That's a good one, isn't it?
It is a great one.
Yeah, a lot of wordplay going on there.
Absolutely.
What about your other one? Do you have any others?
Colorful living tip number 143. Sometime when you're pumping gas and feeling really naughty, remove your credit card really, really slowly. Just to stick it to the man.
Fight the power.
Fight the power.
You have one more.
I believe I do. Colorful living tip number 359. Realize even the most successful vegetable farmers are doomed to live in the seediest parts of town.
Thank you, Jeff.
My pleasure. Can we go have another drink?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's do that indeed.
Thank you.
This is the time of year I always find myself wondering if the Republic of Turkey has a national bird. I'm sure I'd find my wondering betrays a vast ignorance about a proud and noble people, residents of a staunch NATO ally and a bastion of secular democracy in a Middle East that seems forever inflamed by tyrants driven by deadly religious passions. Remember, this was written in 2013. Only an idiot would sit down at grace every year and distractedly wonder during the blessing if the turkey is Turkish. But I cannot escape the thought. I dream of one day taking the kids to Turkey and promising it'll be like the summer we went to Hershey, only with Thanksgiving themes. We're going to spend a couple of days at the Cranberry Soft Seaside Resort before heading to the Stuffing Mountain Range. And I hear nearby Mount Mashed Potato is great this time of year, so we're taking all our ski gear. There'll be the pleasure of boating down the Gravy River, sightseeing through Candy Carrot Forest, and it'd have to be a dandy amusement park in the Candied Yam Land. To me, the nation's name represents a classic chicken and egg question. Which came first, turkey or turkey? I encourage you to look it up because I won't. I'm charmed by the idea that the two are related, and researching things like origins might demolish some of my naive preconceptions. I like believing if I could go to Turkey and greet the natives there by saying gobble gobble, and they'd find it so original and hilarious, they'd say, gee, are all Americans as funny as you? Because if they are, we love America. USA, USA, USA. I wonder what people in Turkey think about Thanksgiving, and I wonder if they eat turkey in Turkish restaurants in downtown Istanbul. I doubt it, and I would wonder how many businesses got off planes with their mouths watering for a turkey dinner and left exasperated after a steady diet of pilaf and lamb kebabs. Certainly some of them have access to the Food Network programming, which for a few days next week will all be about turkey and turkeys and Thanksgiving. So some people in Turkey will see smiling Americans of various ethnicities talking about how much fun it is to roast turkey, deep fry turkey, and shove various side dishes up turkey butts. Much would be lost in the translation. It might all sound completely different to people who live in Turkey. It may sound like a declaration of war. I know many U.S. patriots who would go straight to DEFCON 5 if they saw a broadcast of a voluptuous dark-skinned woman saying, first, you want to tie America up, pour seasonings on it, then fill its empty carcass with stale bread, and then shove it in the preheated oven for 2 hours. When America's cooked, slice it up into succulent pieces and feed it to your children. Oh, they'd be sure to thank Allah for all the America chow filling up our bellies. So being diplomatically minded, I'm just going to try and get out in front of this because I can imagine one day people of Turkey will become furious when they realize people in America have one day a year where everyone celebrates eating turkey. There's no reason to believe political correctness stops at our shores. So this Thanksgiving, there should be some sort of an educational outreach to reassure the Turks we are talking about and consuming a delicious native bird and not one of our most essential allies in a region vital to our national interests. And I hope any Turks reading this will take no offense at my simple-minded jests. The last thing I want to do on Thanksgiving is ruffle any turkey feathers. 228. It says something about American priorities that there are a plethora of erectile dysfunction ads, yet none proposing cures for the cerebral kind. I was strolling through the local mall yesterday and found myself feeling an odd sort of nostalgia for a heterosexual man like myself. I was in front of Victoria's Secret, a store I haven't set foot in about 12 years. I thought, I wonder if they've redecorated the dressing rooms since I was in there pretending I was a transvestite. I don't know why I haven't written about this before, but I was once tagged to do wacky field reports for one of the Pittsburgh morning radio giggle shows. It was during my swashbuckling heyday for National Enquirer, from about 1994 to 2000. Back then, I'd do anything for just about an outlandish laugh and a buck. I guess I still would, but what I would do now, basically nothing, is such an outlandish way to make a living, I don't know how I could top it. The radio station had just been taken over by a communications conglomerate that promised to shower them with big bucks. The boys there liked my segments enough to they wanted me to sprinkle some of the loot on me. What would you say to doing your hidden mic pranks using your wacky brand of humor? We'll pay you $300 per stunt. Sold! The gig lasted one day, and they never paid me a cent. Turns out Victoria's secret is that she has no sense of humor. I found this out during my very first scheme. They dispatched me and a producer to the mall, with me rigged with a hidden microphone. And I'm being candid here on the assumption that statute of limitations on childish radio pranks has expired as soon as the station went to the next commercial. I took great pains to visually and aromatically prepare for the prank that would be in the broadcast only on the radio. I got a haircut, trimmed up my mustache, put on a dashing suit, splashed on some cologne, and did my best to look like a short Tom Selleck. And pulling that off wasn't as difficult as you think. Really, it was easy to appear handsome for women who are used to seeing men dressed like they were in a rush to find a deer to gut, as are so many men around here this time of year. So the three lovely ladies at the counter smiled and straightened up a bit when they saw me approach. We bantered for a bit, and then I made the pivot to business. I have a very important date this evening, the outcome of which could determine the direction of my entire life. I would do anything to make this darling person happier than they've ever been. Everything must be perfect. That's why I came to you. I need something that is both daring yet coy. It has to accentuate the body parts of a man finds irresistible. It needs to have enough frilly distractions to tease while still offering instant access for when passions can no longer be restrained. I need something now, and I don't care how much it costs. I started feeling a little bit guilty at this point because I'd in those 3 minutes become their dream customer. I'd placed my romantic future in their hands, and they were self-assured enough in their knowledge of women, love, and lingerie that they knew I was going to deliver. The younger girls deferred to the more senior, a stunning brunette. "I'm sure we can help you," she said. "Let's start with her size." "Oh, it's not for a woman," I said. "It's for me." These were simpler times. We all had an idea about what a gay man was supposed to look and act like. Think Richard Simmons in a tutu. It was like I'd detonate a gay bomb near the brassiere display tree. The jaws of all three went crashing to the counter. They'd never experienced anything like I'd presented. Two of them were completely unnerved, while the third recovered nicely, although with a red-faced stammer that maintained intact throughout the duration of my visit. "Well, let's have a look at some Merry Widows, okay? Okay?" And together we browsed. I finally settled on three really racy numbers and asked her to show me to the fitting rooms. I guess I was in there about 20 minutes. I held each of the outfits up to my body to see how they looked in the mirror. I didn't try any of them on. I thought they all looked good enough that if I tried even one of them on, it might necessitate a drastic lifestyle change that would put me in an unusual strain on my relationship with my wife. I finally emerged, said that I was thinking of going in a different direction, and asked if there was a latex paint store in the mall. The only thing that had me nervous was that the recorder might malfunction. It did not, and on the very next day, we played the whole tape on air to much hilarity. It was later that day that Furious Company's attorneys called the station with all kinds of threats. The station caved. There were some key personnel changes, and my career in Giggle Radio came to a swift close. So I confessed to feeling a swirl of regret yesterday as I gazed into that store with all the lusty inspirations. Because, yeah, I think I look pretty dynamite in that little pink teddy. If a diplomatic rooster tries to avert a cockfight, is it fair to call him chicken? I hope you enjoyed it, and will tell friends if you did. Have a great week, and thanks for listening. I hope you're enjoying the podcast as much as I'm enjoying presenting it.